And we're talking today to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the new book, Opera Unveiled, now in its 15th year. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. Welcome, Desiree, to the Radio Cafe.
Hello, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be here.
And we're talking today about the opera, The Grand Duchess of Gerolstein by Jacques Offenbach.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, may I read the first paragraph of your chapter from Opera Unveiled? Because it cracked me up. Okay, here we go. The Grand Duchess of Gerolstein is a comic romp of waltzes, galops, military marches, and rousing music set in Santa Fe's production in a military academy in the United States with the outrageous, fictitious Duchess as patroness of the establishment. This intentionally satirical piece about military preparedness, war games, and political maneuverings was an immediate success for its composer, and Jacques Offenbach and his leading lady Hortense Schneider when it first appeared at the tiny Théâtre Varietés in Paris in 1867. The Duchess manages an entire army, promoting men up and down the official ranks while falling in and out of love with the nearest good-looking man at a moment's notice. That is pretty much the plot.
That's true. I know. That's the plot. It's great. I mean, opera has such a reputation for having wordy, lengthy, complicated, confused plots that you'd need a PhD in unraveling genealogy in order to sort it out. Not with this one. But it is comedy. It's farce. It's parody. It's satire. It's all of those things, which was why it was such a big success at the time of its premiere in 1867 in Paris. And one of the reasons, I suppose by the same token, why we are not doing it in Paris in 1867, because everything that was funny to the Parisians at that time, which was a high point, depending on your point of view, of French history and the Second Empire, and it doesn't really make sense to us now. We don't have that historical knowledge or background.
I think one of the things that is interesting that scholars have to do, which we don't often think about, is try to figure out what was funny at the time that nobody gets anymore.
Yes.
And then in the case of doing a production like this, taking that type of humor and making it contemporary.
Yeah. It's a sort of a rewrite job while you still try and keep some semblance of the original plot. Though all of these opera bouffe, as they were called by Offenbach, had a lot of leeway. There was an awful lot of ad-libbing. A lot of topical stuff went in. And every performance was slightly different. In fact, this was one of the problems that the censors had with this opera. It's very critical of the army and power and politics. And the censors said, well, you know, if we do allow this, and this to go through, there can be no ad-libbing, which was really tough for the company because the success of Offenbach's operas often were the ad-libbing and often at the expense of people who were in the audience. It was done nicely, but it got the laughs, which wouldn't work for us.
There were censors in late 19th century Paris?
Censors were rife for a long time. And Verdi spent his life fighting censors. This opera, too, it was not allowed to be performed in contemporary times. It was set much further back in time. And though nobody was fooled. I mean, everybody knew what it was he was talking about. But the Duchess, for instance, she appears in military attire. They didn't think that was appropriate for a woman who was wearing, if not a crinoline, but something like that at the time. She couldn't dress like that. And this woman could not be seen falling in love with a common soldier and a baron simultaneously. These things were not appropriate. They were funny, and that's why they were such a success. And why the people who went to these shows, who were these people? I mean, they just took them from the audience, dressed up as they were, put them on stage, and everyone had a blast. It was great fun. But the censors, no, they were pretty strict. And there was this proviso, yes, you have got to stay with the text as we approve it. No ad-libbing. And that had been the source of great success for him with some of his earlier operas, with La Vie Parisienne and pieces La Belle Hélène. It was the side jokes that were funny. And we'll probably get that here in Santa Fe too. I hope so. The whole thing is set here. They've literally crossed the pond with it. They've taken it from Paris and brought it to a military, fictitious military academy in this country, though you can think West Point. And there are all these young, eager types who are working out with their girlfriends and doing track and field events in the opening. The whole thing is a farce. It's a send-up.
And so we have presumably some rather buff opera singers.
Absolutely. Well, I imagine, yes. It seems to keep cropping up now. Audiences love it. Some of these singers, I mean, they're not asked about how they're going to interpret the role, but how are they going to be dressed or not dressed for the, right. for the part?
What is their workout routine?
Yeah, typically men get asked this question too, which is interesting, not the women.
Going back to this whole question of censorship, I mean, was the issue the Grand Duchess of Gerolstein's sexual proclivities, or was it kind of that it was an anti-war piece? Or
It was a little bit of both. They could only get away with so much. This was very critical of power in the hands of the wrong people, who manipulated the army to their own advantage. I mean, in this opera, the soldiers are sent off to a fictitious war with a fictitious enemy just so that they look good. And there are examples of that in history. You know, we know that. The whole point of this opera, in a sense, and the sad point, is that it did backfire, because 3 years after this premiered, with the heads of Europe all going to the shows, Tsar Alexander apparently arrived in Paris, and 3 hours later he's sitting in the theater. He was a little concerned because he'd heard there was criticism of Catherine the Great, his noble ancestor. And lo and behold, yes, the singer had been wearing a sash that did suggest Catherine the Great. But when he saw the piece and he fell in love with the singer, and the whole thing was fun and tongue-in-cheek, and it passed. But there were also in the audience the generals who were leading the armies that unfortunately 3 years later led to the Franco-Prussian War, and the people who had laughed side by side in the theater found themselves heading armies in that terrible war. So that was the kiss of death for the opera, because suddenly it was no longer funny or politically correct to laugh at the maneuvers of the army, and it actually closed the show and was the beginning of the downfall of Offenbach, who had been the toast of Paris. He was a big rock star. They called him Mozart of the boulevards, but now that this opera was persona non grata, they turned on him and they realized he's German, he's the enemy, and we can't be having this. And it destroyed him. It was very sad.
And if you, as you say in the book, he was as French could be.
Yes, he really was. He was trained in the Paris. He was the son of a German cantor who went to Paris in his early teens with his brother, and they studied at the Paris Conservatoire, and they formed this art form. I mean, opera bouffe is the style of Offenbach, and he gave it to France. It sort of grew out of opera comique, and which was opera buffa in Italy and operetta in England. So he had done wonders for them, but such is the way of life, I suppose.
And politics.
And the
yes. fundamental incompatibility of humor and militarism.
Yeah, maybe. And that we'll see in the show that the Santa Fe Opera is doing. It promises to be absolutely wonderful. It's a fun piece, and it's moving it to America will make it fun for us. There's also the issue of the language, of course. What do you do? Because the whole thing was written in French. And I think the decision the Santa Fe Opera has made is a very wise one. All of the musical numbers will be in French. But in order to get the dialogue, where there are jokes and puns and all of this, you need to speak the language. And if you're sitting in the audience, you hear a line in French, and then you read it on the titles and then laugh, there's a very nasty time lag, which really throws the singers. It throws the whole thing out. So the dialogue will all be in English, and the numbers will be in French.
So there's spoken, non-sung parts
yeah,
of the opera?
Yeah, this style is musical numbers interspersed with dialogue. As we know musicals today, there's really not a musical. Musical grew out of this art form, so that, you know, they'll talk about something and burst into song, and then talk about something and there's an ensemble or a chorus. But that's the way the whole thing goes through. But with Offenbach, there's a level of excitement from the very beginning. I mean, he developed the can-can. He didn't ever make it respectable, but the can-can first appeared in Orpheus in the Underworld, his piece. And there's a lot of can-can music in this. I'm going to play, maybe if we have time, one piece of the can-can that ends one act, and you'll see what I mean, the excitement.
Is there can-can dancing?
That's yet to be determined.
Okay.
I doubt the military types on the parade ground will resort to can-cans, but you never know.
So the fabulous Susan Graham is the lead singer in this opera.
Yeah, this is a real coup, I think, that she is singing here. She's from here. She's actually from Roswell. She loves coming to Santa Fe to sing. She's sung many of our leading roles. She was La Belle Hélène. And winter tour back, she did a completely different role. She sang Iphigenia on Tauride, the great Baroque tragedy with Placido Domingo and Paul Groves. She's a wonderful singer. She's a mezzo soprano and has a fantastic career worldwide now. So we're thrilled to have her here this summer. And the director, who's British, Lee Blakely, said that he and Susan got together in the very early days when they knew this was going to come to Santa Fe and plotted the whole thing together. She calls the role of the Duchess, she says she's a cougar in the contemporary meaning of that word, a very glamorous woman who is still in her prime, who is fascinated by every available man. And it's
still
all very
in her prime, meaning 40-something.
Yeah, right. You know, in those days, I mean, that was it. You wore black and disappeared and were not seen anymore, but not anymore. I mean, women are coming into their prime in these years now. Families are grown and they can play. So she calls it that. He says, as Lee Blakely said, that this show is Susan's show. He didn't want to show sort of a dowager type singer who is bored and you know, that's where she's coming from. He says, we have a young and sexy, wonderful leading lady. Let's make the most of it. This is Susan's show. So that's where he's coming from. Yeah, maybe we should play that first entrance of hers. It gives you a real sense of where she's coming from and what the music is like. J'aime le militaire. The whole opera opens and the military academy are all hard at work. General Boom comes in, who is just like his name suggests, and he's ordering around all these young soldiers, and then she makes a grand entrance and she sings J'aime le militaire. I love the military. Let's hear a little of that. J'aime les militaires, j'aime les militaires, j'aime les militaires, leur uniforme coquet, leur moustache et leur plumée. J'aime les militaires, j'aime les militaires, j'aime les militaires, leur évacueur, leur manière, on eut tout le blé. Quand je vois là mes soldats prêts à partir pour la guerre, fixe droit, lui à 15 pas, près de j'en suis toute fière. Seront-ils vainqueurs ou divers? Je n'en sais rien ce que je sais. Je n'en sais rien ce que je sais. Je n'en sais rien ce que je sais. J'aime les militaires, j'aime les militaires, j'aime les militaires. J'aime, oui, j'aime les militaires.
And so we are talking about and listening to music from the opera The Grand Duchess of Gerolstein by Jacques Offenbach with Desiree Mays, always with us.
The year flies by, Mary Charlotte. I don't know what happens, but here we are doing it again. Yeah. Thank goodness. I mean, the Santa Fe Opera has now an incredible reputation. The more I travel around this country and abroad, actually, talking to audiences about opera, I'm asked more and more about the Santa Fe Opera, and especially about this season. People are very excited. They love the idea of a comic piece and then a very romantic piece and then a piece that takes up the issue of human rights, which we will talk about in Oscar, which is the world premiere. So I thought this is a fun piece. The recording I'm using today is the Grand Duchess's Felicity Lott, and the conductor is Mark Minkowski, and it's the Musicians of the Louvre. There's a few recordings out there. This is an excellent one, I think. Sadly, nothing with Susan Graham singing in the leading role yet, but I imagine that will happen. So
let me ask you a question. When, for example, Susan Graham is singing at the Santa Fe Opera, does that get recorded? Do they ever make like live CDs?
This always comes up, and I think the company does archival recordings. They have to do that, but these are not made public, and they are strictly for archival purposes. So unless a recording company comes in to do that, and it's unusual now that this happens, so no, we do not have typically recordings from the Santa Fe Opera, which I think is a shame. These are such fun productions. Though with this one, it's such a visual one. I think this is something you have to come and see and experience live in the theater to really get the best of it.
So even though the story is basically that the Grand Duchess has major crushes on various boys and, you know, then the curtain falls at the end. I mean, let's talk a little bit about the story because it's a little more complicated than that.
Yes, it is. The first act is just sort of to set the scene and to introduce us to Baron Puck and General Boom, who are in cahoots. They really want the power. They want to stay in control, and they like manipulating the Duchess, who technically is their superior. And so they plan these games for her, and they plan to go to war for her, and so that is to keep her amused. They've also chosen her a husband, Prince Paul, who they think they can manipulate and be in control of. But when he shows up, she's not the least bit interested because currently she has her eyes set on Fritz. Now, Fritz is one of the few young soldiers who, when she appears, is not going crazy about her entrance. And he catches her eye, and she talks to him a little bit. He says, just tell me your war experience. And he says, zero wounds, zero battles. So he's not the best material. But nevertheless, she promotes him up the ranks. He becomes a captain and a colonel, and everything happens very fast. And the general is standing aghast. Of course, he's not happy at all about this. And it turns out that Fritz has a girlfriend. He's a little awkward, and he doesn't, well, we're not sure. It'll be interesting to see how this is played in this production. We're not sure whether he is really as klutzy as he looks. He doesn't seem to be aware that the Duchess is chasing him because he's much more interested in Wanda, his girlfriend with whom he is in love and wants to get married to. And when the Duchess keeps approaching him, he sort of acts very vague, though he may understand what's going on. It's not clear. Anyway, the next, after we've met all of these characters and we're beginning to get a sense of the nonsense that's going on, there's a regimental march that she decides she will be the leader. She will be the lead singer and lead the regimental march. So maybe we could hear a little of that next.
L'honneur pour sentiment et la victoire, il a ça pour maîtresse.
Ah, mais son superbe étonnant, quand il arrive quelque part.
Les femmes, elles sont enchantées, mais c'est les hommes qui font peiner.
Quand ils sont dans le régiment, les choses, elles se passent autrement.
Les hommes, ils ont l'air enchantés, mais c'est les femmes qui font peiner. À ça pour le jeu.
À contre le feu.
À ça pour le jeu.
This is music from The Grand Duchess of Gerolstein by Jacques Offenbach. And you can just practically see the pageantry on stage
and
as you're
marching.
Listening to it.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, yeah. It's that's what it's all about. I mean, not much else happens in this piece. Though I must say the Duchess does have one moment of introspection. There is hope for her. She's not constantly flirting with all these various soldiers. She, in the middle of the opera, she has fallen for Fritz. He's paying her no attention. He goes off to fight this war, and he comes back victorious. It turns out he made the enemy, whoever they were, drunk, so it was very easy to beat them. He comes back and sings a long aria about all of that. And they're going to have a victory ball, and she's thrilled, and she thinks that now she's making some headway with Fritz. But in the midst of all this, she overhears Fritz and Wanda singing together about their love and how happy they are, and Fritz turns to her, the Duchess, and says, would it be possible, would you sign our marriage certificate for tonight at the ball? And she's absolutely furious. So she decides she's going to go over to the enemy, who happen to be the Baron and the General, all these people who are plotting against Fritz because they're jealous. They want him demoted. He's now the General. So the plot is
Even though he hasn't really ever accomplished anything.
He has accomplished nothing at all. No. And even this battle that they went off to. I mean, there's a wonderful scene where the women there are women in this opera with the Duchess, and they're receiving love letters from the front. And this is a great send-up, too. It's all done in French rhyming couplets, which is something we may miss in English translation, but it's another little farcical thing that's done. So she gets so angry that Fritz will not return her affection that she decides she'll join the enemy. And they've dreamt up this marvelous plot of straight melodrama. It turns out that the Duchess had an ancestress years ago, and she also had a little assignation with some lesser being who would visit her by a secret passage at night. He would come through the secret passage and they would get together. But one night it wasn't the lover who came, it was an assassin who came, and it was all very dramatic. And they're going to replay this straight gothic melodrama with Fritz. That's the plan. And when she hears about it, now she's angry enough to say, yes, I will go along with it and you can do this. But then she has this little moment of introspection where she says, what am I doing? I mean, this is really not right. Let me read you actually from the libretto here. She says, when I look into myself, what I see is frightening. To tell that handsome soldier I love you was already more than just flirting. He scorned me. I persisted. And now I'm going to have him killed. Is this how I've started? It bodes well for the future. Heaven has given me a charming little disposition. So it's not too serious. It's not the usual great, long, introspective aria that opera is so well known for. But it's fun, and it is a little moment. It's a great moment for the soprano. It turns out there were a number of different versions of this opera. First of all, the first one was way too long, and it had to be cut, so Offenbach cut it. And different things happened in different cities. They seemed to add and subtract from these operas at that time at will. But recently some music has been recovered that was part of the original production, and we're including all of that in our production. So anyone who knows this piece is actually going to get music that was never done before. We Santa Fe Opera did this opera many years ago under John Crosby. He loved this opera. But without some of the numbers we're going to be seeing this summer. And this is one, the meditation of the Duchess at this point.
Now, you say the music was recovered. What was it, in some trunk in an attic or something?
I think, yes, it was one of those findings. I don't know the details, but yes, it was rediscovered. It had been lost in some archives. And because each new director and conductor would put the piece together their own way, we are doing the entire thing, which I think is great. I mean, opera can do that these days. In addition, I found, too, that opera audiences now have much greater tolerance for longer operas. I think we have Wagner to thank for that. Everyone thought, oh, this is going to be so long, I can't do it. And they find they can do it. So.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the tailgate party in which you eat heartily beforehand.
Yeah, well, that's another thing. That adds to it, too. You have a great long night at the opera when you go to Santa Fe if you start with a tailgate party. So maybe we should play a little of the meditation and
hear. This is the introspective part.
This is the such as it is in this opera. Let's hear from, this is Felicity Lott singing the meditation of the Grand Duchess.
Dire à ce beau soldat, je t'aime, c'était déjà plus que galant. Il me déteigne, je me bute, et je veux le faire mourir. Si c'est ainsi que je débute, cela promet pour l'avenir, cela promet pour l'avenir. Oh mon Dieu, mon Dieu, mon Dieu, mon Dieu. J'avais pourtant reçu du ciel. Mon Dieu, mon Dieu.
that's the Duchess's meditation. Nothing too in depth or nothing to worry about in this piece. So she's had this little sort of second thoughts about what she's doing. But meantime, the conspirators carry on. And there's another lovely little in joke here. They all get together and they decide they're going to assassinate Fritz, okay? And they all get their knives and their swords out. And one of them asks, is he unarmed? And they say, yes, he is. So they say, fine, we'll go for it. But the actual music parody here is something that the French audiences would have known that I would not have known without doing the research. It turns out that Meyerbeer was a great composer at the time at the Paris Opera, and someone to whom Offenbach would love to have been Meyerbeer but couldn't. Meyerbeer did an opera called The Huguenots, and a high point of that opera is where the conspirators get together to sharpen their swords before they go kill the enemy. So he takes that little scene and he puts it into his opera. So it's hilarious. I mean, it's an absolute stand-up of the great, serious Meyerbeer. And they put it into the Grand Duchess of Gerolstein. So let's hear a little of that trio, complete with the chorus. The chorus have a lot of work in this opera. I mean, there's actually probably more chorus work in this opera than in any other this summer.
And the chorus is often made up of the wonderful apprentices.
That's right. The apprentices this year, I think there are about 40 apprentices chosen from nearly 1,000 singers who audition for the Santa Fe Opera in order to do this. Auditions are held all around the country to choose the right singers for these different parts. And they make up the chorus, they play the small roles, and they often, or they do typically cover for the principals.
And every once in a while they go on. Yeah.
Exactly. They actually go on with the altitude here. It's tough on singers, so sometimes they don't make all the performances. They get sick or whatever it is. And these young singers have their chance. And I must say, this opera company has launched the careers of many great singers through the apprentice program. Now, when I say apprentice, then it's not as if they've never been out on the stage before. These are kids who are in the final years of their training. They've had a lot of stage experience. Many of them have sung leading roles in small opera houses. But to come here to Santa Fe to be part of this extraordinary summer festival with the world's best directors and conductors, set designers, the whole level.
And singers.
Is so incredible. And they can model. And we'll talk with La Traviata, with an interview with a couple of these singers who explain how they start here and how they go on to great things and very often come back to Santa Fe in leading roles. So with the Grand Duchess, it's a demanding piece for them. Not only must they be able to sing, they have to be superb dancers as well. So that's part of the, I imagine, the process of choosing singers who really can dance as well as sing. And in this case, the dancing always has been stunning here.
So they're not just choosing great singers, but they're really choosing people for each specific opera.
To a certain extent, I mean, if you find an extraordinary voice that is right for a role, they will be chosen. And then, you know, there's a certain amount of working around that if need be. But today, Mary Charlotte, the breadth of education that any young singer has is quite extraordinary. They must be able to speak different languages. Over and beyond singing, they have to be very fit. There was a wonderful moment early on in the spring when Nathalie Dessay sang Cleopatra in Julius Caesar. And she was asked in the intermission, how did you train for this role? Because she dances. This is a singer who loves to dance. And she did all this very energetic dancing. And she said, you know, I practice yoga every day. That's how I am able to dance in this opera. And I think, I know that Natalie actually, I think, started getting into yoga here at Santa Fe when she came and sang our La Traviata, La Sonnambula, because in the morning, out on the grass on those gorgeous lawns, there's a yoga class that the singers and the staff can go to. It's a way of warming up. When you get the body warmed up, then the voice and the brain, everything else is focused, and it works well.
Well, also, I mean, several years ago we had a different Offenbach. It was Tales of Hoffmann.
Right.
And there was a vocalist, a singer who was practically climbing to the ceiling.
Yes. Yeah, I met with her. I talked with her. And I watched her at a rehearsal. And she was doing yoga poses you can only dream about. I promise you, this is not a novice yoga practitioner. She was quite wonderful and is making a major career for herself. She's now singing the lead in Cinderella. And when I talked to her, she said, yes, that yoga was something that really focused her mind and her body, so that she can do virtually anything she wants. So now that the bar is very high for young singers, they have to be able to be very all round, and it would have to be a truly unbelievably outstanding voice to be able to do without all of that today. So 1,000 singers, the production team have not a difficult time finding exactly what they want, but they look at them with an eye to what is their potential for the future and can they cover for the leading role. So.
And also, they're probably each in multiple operas.
Yes, that's the real challenge with rehearsal schedules, where directors would like to have their entire cast all to themselves for 1 month to rehearse a show. Certainly something like this. There's so much going on. And that's a luxury nobody has these days, especially here when two or three operas can be in rehearsal simultaneously and often with the same singers. So they're running from place to place. I wonder if a computer handles that.
I don't know. Need a really complicated algorithm.
It's really amazing. So it's challenging. They love it, though. I mean, there's a passion. If you ever go up to the opera, to the cantina during the day, the cantina, everybody's there having lunch in between rehearsals, and you get a real sense of the energy and the friendships that are made, the falling in love that goes on, that one hopes will last beyond the season. It may or may not.
So. Right. I mean, imitating life,
what's
imitating
going
art.
On stage, exactly. Yeah. So it's exciting. Let's hear a little of the Grinders Trio, but they're sharpening their swords because they're all planning to kill Fritz. And again, it's a little tongue-in-cheek send-up of Meyerbeer's Les Huguenots. Thank you.
We are listening to music from The Grand Duchess of Gerolstein by Jacques Offenbach. We're talking with Desiree Mays about the Serfe opera. As we mentioned before, Susan Graham is going to be singing the main role, the role of the Duchess, in this production of the Serfe opera.
Yes, and I found a lovely cut of hers. YouTube is quite incredible for opera. If anybody doesn't know an opera and they want to get a sense of what it's about, go to YouTube and put their name in. You'll be there for hours. It's quite wonderful what's up there. And this was a find on YouTube where Susan was asked about singing in another language and how you have to become part, really know a lot more than just the words. You have to be able to get into the language, and that's another challenge for singers these days, and she does it so beautifully. Her French is pretty flawless, as is her Italian and German. So let's hear a little of it. This cut is actually, she you'll hear from Susan herself. She introduces a French song, J'ai deux amants, I have two loves. Let's hear from Susan.
There's a lot of acting that comes into singing in a language that is not your own, because you have to feel that it is your own. You have to make believe that you are a native French speaker.
J'ai deux amants, c'est beaucoup mieux que je fais croire à chacun d'eux que l'autre le monsieur. je ne sais pas comment nous sommes. Nous sommes, nous sommes. Mais mon Dieu, que c'est pas de l'homme. À l'homme, à l'homme. Excusez-moi. Mon Dieu, que c'est pas de l'homme. Alors, vous pensez de...
You can get a little sense of the French style just from that tiny clip. And if you go to YouTube, there's many, many more pieces of Susan Graham singing everything from De Rosenkavalier, because she's a mezzo-soprano, so she sings pants rolls a lot. You know, she doesn't often get into a dress. In this, she's going to be gorgeously gowned. I think that was one of the fun parts for her, that she could wear these fabulous clothes. But other than that, yeah, go and check it out online. They're fun.
It's really fun to kind of see the behind-the-scenes process.
It is, and I think that's something that the HD screenings have done a fabulous job with. At the beginning, I thought, a singer comes off stage in the middle of some dramatic piece and are nabbed as soon as the curtain's gone by somebody who then does an interview. That's really tough, but they do it well, and I think it gives one a real sense of where they're coming from, because it's very spontaneous, as has been maybe more spontaneous than they might have wanted. And then they actually show how they change those massive sets at the Met in minutes, how they clear an entire scene and bring another one on. It gives you a little sort of a bird's eye view. And people here, when they come to Santa Fe, you know, you can go on backstage tours. That's something that's very popular. Every Monday to Friday, you can go. You can just show up, I think, at 9 o'clock when it's still not too hot in the summer. And there's a docent there who will give you a really wonderful backstage tour. If they're using the main stage, you probably won't be allowed onto it, but you'll get close to it. And you can go through the costumes and see wigs and sets. That's a really fun thing to do, because it gives you a whole other perspective. I remember when we were doing Salome, there was a group that I was with going backstage, and the prop director, Randy, brought out the head of John the Baptist, which had been measured to be the same size as the singer's head, so it would sort of approximate the singer. And one woman went completely white and all but faded away, because, you know, you suddenly are faced with it. And then they discussed the weight. You know, what's the weight of a head? It turns out, the things you learn, that your head weight is about one-third of your body weight. I mean, that's an amazing something like that. I'm not good on numbers, but it's much heavier than you'd expect. And yet the singer can't manage to do that final aria holding and rolling around on the floor with a fair weight.
37-pound head.
Yeah, right. So it could be a 5-pound or a 2-pound, in which case you want to be careful that there's not a high wind blowing that night. I mean, terrible things happen. But that's the sort of thing you can experience if you go backstage, which is a fun thing to do. If you haven't done it, do it, but bring a hat and sunscreen, because it's a sort of a couple of hours and you're out in the hot sun and you never know what you're going to see. I mean, it's always different. So that's a fun way of getting an inside look at what goes on backstage at the theater. I have one more piece of music to play. Perhaps we could wrap this up then with that. It's called The Carillon. This was not in the productions that had typically been seen. It's another piece that's been brought back. I don't think it was lost, this piece, but it wasn't often done. The grandmother's carry-on that starts slowly but then builds up into this can-can. So if as you're listening to it, you just shut your eyes and see can-can, you'll know exactly what I mean and the excitement that ends this act.
What is the actual, if we can call it, plot that's happening right now?
Well, the plot goes, what happens in the plot is after she decides to join the conspirators, the cue to the conspirators is if the carillon is played, they are to go ahead with the plot. And they play it and they get the green light to do it. But then she has second thoughts and she decides, no, she can't do this. And not only that, but she finds another interesting man, Baron Grog. Now, Baron Grog has been sent to the court to be an emissary for Prince Paul, who's supposed to be betrothed to the Duchess. But he's getting nowhere whatsoever. I mean, nothing's going on, and she's ignoring him. But she rather likes Baron Grog. So Baron Grog says to her, why don't you marry the prince, and then maybe I can stay at court, and I'll be around. So she agrees to that, and there's going to be this big wedding. And at that point, she backs off the assassination plot, and she says, you know, I really can't have an assassination on the day of my wedding. wedding. And at the same time, Baron Grog informs her that he has a wife and four children, that he's leaving the day after the wedding. So it's, again, all farce and silliness. But she finally does marry her prince, her Prince Paul.
And I think operas like this are fun because you really don't get caught up in the drama of it. Mm-hmm. You really get to watch it and have a good time. But really, I mean, there's no suspension of disbelief or any of that kind of thing.
No, you're not struggling to get it. I mean, you just have to sit back
and
enjoy it.
Or like La Traviata, where your heart is being ripped to shreds.
At the end, yes. No, nothing like that. You will bounce out into the car park and you will not mind if you have to wait a bit to get your car out of the 2,000 cars that leave there at night. In fact, that's something else I think people should enjoy. Either hang out a few minutes, wait in 15 minutes, walk around, look at the stars. It's so stunning up there. And we are doing earlier curtains, of course, Mary Charlotte. Now, in July, the curtain is at 8:30, not 9 o'clock.
Ah.
And in August, the curtain is at 8. So this is a big shift. And
have they made a deal with the sun to go down?
Well, that was part of it. They couldn't do anything about the sun, but the general director, Charles McKay, sat down with the directors and said, look, how can we deal with this? And with lighting, set designers, how are we going to work this? And they are now, the last year they did this for the first time and found that it really did work. But you have to plan for it. You can tell exactly when the sun will set. And sometimes they'll actually include it. In the Pearlfishers, for instance, last summer, part of those the high points of the opera was the setting sun, at which point the chorus would actually turn upstage as the sun was setting. And then the lighting has to fit in with that. And, of course, it comes up a different time each night. So it's more of a challenge. But apparently they enjoyed the challenge, and it's possible. And I think it's made a big difference to audiences. Going to theater at 9 o'clock at night may be done in Europe, but it was not altogether popular here.
And I think it's very civilized myself.
I do think it's marvelous. It does give you time to eat dinner ahead of time because you're not going to eat afterwards. So that works. So this final piece, the Carillon, is, as I said, it launches into the Can-Can and ends one of the acts. Let's hear the Carillon, grandmother's Carillon, from the Grand Duchess of Gerolstein. And that's the wonderful Carillon from the Grand Duchess of Gerolstein that the Santa Fe Opera presents this summer. We've talked about Susan Graham being the Grand Duchess, and her Fritz, who is important, is Paul Appleby, is a wonderful young tenor who I saw this spring, actually, in Dialogue of the Carmelites at the Met. He's making a big career for himself, and I think will be lovely in that role. With a French conductor, Emmanuel Villaume, will be conducting our production at the Santa Fe Opera this summer.
So this is really a piece for the whole family, the Grand Duchess of Gerolstein by Jacques Offenbach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think bring the kids to this one. It'll be fun.
Desiree Mays, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe. And we're going to go out with the overture to the opera. Is that correct?
Yes, this brings in a lot of the little themes that are in the opera. And it's a fun piece. It really sets the stage in your own mind before you ever go. And I hope to see everybody up there at the Grand Duchess.
We've been talking to Desiree Mays, international opera lecturer and storyteller, and author of the book Opera Unveiled. She speaks every night at the Preview Buffet at the Opera. The Santa Fe Opera is on the web at santafeopera.org, and the phone number is 800-280-4654, and the local number is 505-986-5900.